So I'm fine if others have more of an alarmist tone. I don't necessarily know that that is wrong. In fact, I think for the right kind of person, that can be very motivating. That being said, there is some research that shows being a bit alarmist can also turn a lot of people off.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 17 of Damn the Absolute. Debates about reversing climate change can be understood as a tension between two groups, wizards and prophets. According to Charles C. Mann, wizards are tech optimists, those who believe that technology resolves more problems than it creates, that technology will save us from the climate crisis. It has advanced us this far, and it will continue doing so. Think of the innovations in alternative energy, such as wind and solar power. On the other hand, prophets are more focused on how culture shapes our choices. They believe we need to live more within our means, exercise more humility about what we're able to control or even manage. For prophets, we face this climate crisis because of human hubris and the reality that we are taking more from the earth than it can give. This is certainly a clarifying model for understanding the discourse around our perhaps most ubiquitous challenge in the 21st century. But what if there's a more productive middle way between these two perspectives? Ross Kenyon is a co-founder of the Nori Carbon Removal Marketplace, where he serves as creative editor. He has had a varied career, working in an academic center and taking PhD coursework in political philosophy before switching to screenwriting and producing content. He currently leads Nori's creative media efforts, hosting their Reversing Climate Change podcast and producing the Carbon Removal Newsroom podcast. Kenyon exemplifies a curiosity-driven approach to reversing climate change. He minimalizes polemics or alarmist rhetoric, hoping that doing so will bring more voices to the climate crisis table. While he freely admits his communication style doesn't work for everyone, he believes we need this pluralistic vision to reversing climate change if we're going to have much success in reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. A few questions to ponder. What role does literature or climate fiction have in convincing us of the urgency around the climate crisis? How bad are things now? And what will our failure to reverse climate change mean for geopolitical issues such as war, immigration, starvation, and drought? How do we get people with conflicting ideologies to work together toward shared problems? And what should we personally be doing to help reverse climate change? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Ross, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here. I think you've been on our show a couple times, right? Two times?
Twice, yes.
Yeah. Talking about what, communitarianism and then one on pragmatism. Next time I get an ism up, I know who to call.
Yeah, let me know if you have any other isms we need to dance with. So this will be a familiar practice to you by now. What is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were confident wouldn't change that's actually shifted dramatically?
I really like that question. I know you have made a point of asking many guests this, and I've been trying to think of the best example of this. I think it's foundationalism, or I was really working for a long time. I spent some time doing graduate work in philosophy, and I always felt like I was getting closer to figuring out what is the most basic understanding that one can build a worldview around. And I sort of lost faith in that project in a big way. The school I was studying at, Arizona, they are a public reason school. Their focus is on Rawls and what came after Rawls. And it ended in this point of basically of saying that, well, do you want me to explain this, by the way?
Yes, please do. And I do want to leave a note that you bring up public reason. We do have a previous episode with Kevin Vallier talking about some public reason, liberalism, and other related things. So if people want to check that out, but continue, Ross.
Yeah, Kevin was, you know, some years ahead of me in that and way, way, way more knowledgeable than I am about it. I just took classes for a year before deciding it wasn't the right route for me. But yeah, so one of Rawls's ideas, John Rawls, political philosopher, is called the original position. How would you design the rules of society if you didn't know which person you would be, whether you'd be the wealthiest, most powerful, or the least powerful? What sets of rules might be most acceptable to people without knowing which role they would inherit? And Rawls was pretty conservative, not politically, but in the sense that he thought people would be very risk averse and choose a pretty strict egalitarianism. And so this post-Rawlsian tradition at Arizona basically thought that rational people could legitimately rank values and risks differently. Someone could choose a society that was more unequal, but overall wealthier. And that's something that someone could legitimately choose. Like a rational person could choose that. Once you get to that point, though, and there are multiple answers and it's sort of values driven or up to one's discretion, there's no longer a set answer. There's no longer a sort of coherent baseline that is not something that leads to democratic deliberation or is unsettled in that way. Anyways, that plus postmodernism well and truly blew my mind. And I sort of gave up on the attempts of trying to find, I kept trying to dig down to the bottom and then I just found it was muck after muck and nothing else. So I sort of quit and went into art instead.
Mucky turtles all the way down. I think you'll find some kinship in the Damn the Absolute community. A lot of anti-foundationalists here who have mired in that same struggle. So you're with friends.
I don't have anything better to replace it. I just sort of gave up. So I think pragmatism is one attempt to deal with this. I think you're farther along in dealing with it than I ever made it.
John Dewey has a quote, one of my favorites, and that is in regards to a lot of philosophical problems. Many of them we don't solve. We just get over. You're obviously not over the problem of foundationalism, but maybe there will be a point in which you just get over it.
I love that. That's such a great line. And I suspect it's true. It's maybe a little bit depressing in a way. Is it depressing or is it empowering or just true? I don't know. I don't want to backlead though. I feel like I'm a little bit of a backleader since I'm so used to asking questions. So I'm gonna zip it.
Well, let's dive in to climate change, the climate crisis, the work you do with your company, Nori. You are a host for the Reversing Climate Change podcast. So you spend a lot of time in this space, wrestling with these questions, interviewing a fascinating collection of guests and experts. What are the biggest changes you've seen in the past 5 years regarding how the general public talks about the climate crisis and environmentalism in general?
Probably the biggest is how many entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs have sniffed out business opportunities within what is now called climate tech. A lot of people are trying to move from their jobs that are highly remunerative, but maybe not so satisfying, into something that they think is meaningful. So there's a lot of people who are moving software skills basically into climate change. There's also a lot of cool hardware projects happening too. But anyways, I think climate is emerging as almost a discrete employment sector. So that's been really fun to see. Also carbon removal, when we started at Nori, so we focus primarily, or I should say exclusively, on pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it and helping to build the financial infrastructure to make that possible. Carbon removal, when we started nearly 4 years ago, was a much smaller group. I feel like most of the people seriously devoted to carbon removal could fit inside of one medium-sized banquet hall. And now that is no longer the case. There was an IPCC report a couple years ago that said that without carbon removal, there's really not much of a chance to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So I think that was a big moment where carbon removal had its sort of societal debut, coming down the marble staircase in its gown. God, what a terrible thing I just did. Horrible imagery.
What is the unique bend in which you are trying to remove carbon from the atmosphere? What is the unique take or offering that Nori is attempting?
We're a marketplace and we want to make it as scalable as possible to do this. One of the ways existing, or I should say legacy offset registries work, oftentimes they'll list opportunities to buy offsets as project-based. So sometimes you'll go on a website and you'll have to look through dozens, hundreds. I don't even know. I don't know what the top level is. Maybe there's even more than 1,000 on some of them. Mm-hmm. Probably not. But that's a huge amount of things to compare against. And I don't know that that approach is particularly scalable. One of the risks, though, is that you simplify too far in trying to commoditize something. And you have all of these things that are not equivalent that you're attempting to make fungible and exchangeable for one another. And you're losing track of the small, the particular stuff that I know you obsess over because I listen to your show as well. But it's a bit of a trade-off scenario too. Like you want to be able to remove lots and lots of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it. But if we do it on this sort of boutique kind of model, it's not going to work. So we're trying to find ways that we can simplify. I think we found some cool ways of doing so while not losing the things that are still really important. I could say more, but maybe I'll pause.
And the most simple language of what Nori's doing is, at least in part, and I've participated in this in a very small way, is paying, for example, a farmer to sequester carbon to offset the carbon emissions that I put into the atmosphere. And they are incentivized to do that because I'm paying them. And they're farmers and they could be doing a lot of different things, but they primarily need to be making some money. And this is one way for them to make money.
That's pretty good. That's a nice summation. We've started with farmers practicing regenerative agriculture. Nori's ultimately agnostic. And I started with that sort of abstract discussion of fungibility and commodities that we can come back to, but maybe it's simpler to start here. Farmers right now in what's called conventional agriculture, with air quotes, is oftentimes quite input intensive. It requires a lot of synthetic fertilizer and pesticide and tillage. All of these things are substitutes for the natural fertility of the soil, which has basically been worn out at this point. And so farmers in many cases and brands who buy from them would very much like them to switch over to practices that do not require synthetic fertilizer and tillage to the same extent. And regenerative agriculture is a way of building natural soil fertility so that you are no longer as reliant upon external inputs. So if you stop tilling nearly so much, if you stop essentially bleaching your soil with synthetic fertilizer, microbial life, if you feed it in the right kinds of ways, using things like cover crops and crop rotations, they're going to take off in there and create a healthy space that supports, I don't know, plant life, I guess you could say. So that is what we are trying to encourage. But it's kind of hard for farmers to stop getting off of all those practices. Your productivity could drop. It's difficult. So helping to get them over that hump to build that natural fertility, I think, is really important. And that's one thing that we're trying to do.
So to zoom out a little bit, I want you to paint a picture for us. What is the current state of the climate crisis? What are some metrics each of us should have our eyes on in helping or being able to understand what's going on?
The ways that people explain this is always somewhat inscrutable. It doesn't map on neatly to anyone's experience. The idea of a global average temperature change, like what does that mean for you? I have no idea. It doesn't sound like a lot either. If someone says climate change, they're trying to limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is still not great, above industrial revolution temperatures. You're like, what does that even mean? I don't know. A simpler way to talk about this is the parts per million of CO2 or CO2 equivalents in the atmosphere. Before the Industrial Revolution, we were at something like 250 parts per million. Right now, we're about 420 parts per million or thereabouts. I think some of the climate communications that we grew up with that are still very powerful are somewhat strange. Oftentimes, there's a focus on polar bears or charismatic species. But the stuff that keeps me up at night in the near future are things like, with climate change, weather patterns change. Some places will be more wet, some places will be more dry, and weather events could be more extreme in that way too. Increased flooding, increased droughts. That could lead to crop failures. Hungry people flood into cities, and that could lead to conflict. Syria, a decade ago and ongoing, is often portrayed as a climate crisis. I think immigrants going to countries not immediately affected in this way cause lots of in-group, out-group conflicts, leads to populist backlash, could lead to armed conflict. The various militaries around the world are preparing for what exactly a climate-changed global security model might look like. Stuff like that I find really, really frightening. Beyond just the pure human toll of people having to leave their homes, dying, extreme weather events, stuff like that. I think that's really the major, the geopolitics of it. Yeah.
I think the geopolitics questions, at least for the layperson, aren't issues that most of us have been thinking about in regards to climate change in the last 5 to 10 years, but those are now becoming more and more. I think we noticed this with the recent presidential election, some debate questions and platforms related to some of these geopolitics that other people just didn't make the connection.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm sure we'll see a lot more of it too. More and more people are talking about climate change, and I think we're going to see a variety of new ways of talking about it to try to engage people. I think insofar as one is concerned about speaking with people who are maybe conservative or maybe not so concerned about climate change, I think the degree to which the U.S. military is preparing for climate change and thinking about this is really fascinating. There's a ton of stuff happening on that front. There's a good book called All Hell Breaking Loose about the Pentagon's planning for climate change. There's a ton of work being done. The Arctic as a new theater of war. Resources will get exposed for the first time and be mineable. A lot of that is not totally clear who owns it. Russia has many icebreakers. The U.S. I think only has one right now. There's going to be a lot of things like that. There's going to be crises that are going to lead to mass emigration. It's going to put stress on various countries.
You're pointing to a bunch of ways that maybe for some people don't seem on the surface connected to climate change, but seem to be very clearly connected. What are some other aspects of society or maybe even disciplines or professions that are intersect with climate change that should be talking about climate change, but are not?
I don't know. We're both weird humanities guys, right? Like, we're not scientists. I think there's a lot of room for engagement. I think there's a lot to do merely on communicating this, and there's a lot of work that can be done just talking about this, essentially. I like when artists do things. I like literature. I like film. Other disciplines, though, many of the people I work with are geographers. They're pretty active. Obviously, people in the hard sciences. There's a lot of work being done on governance and political science too. Like one of the proposals for a future where we do not get a handle on the parts per million in the atmosphere is that either the world as a whole or a country or a set of countries or even private entities release reflective materials into the atmosphere that bounce sunlight off of the planet. Doesn't do much to deacidify the ocean or things like that, which are also concerning, but it does maybe prevent immediate like heat problems, drought, climate change. So, but anyways, the governance of that is who gets to decide when it's time to do that? What if we get to a point where we absolutely must, or something even worse will happen? Some people don't even believe that framing is correct, by the way, but that's a hard political question beyond the science. I know social scientists are working on stuff like that too.
Speaking of framing, in the environmentalism space, there's one model of conversation about approaches to solving the climate change, and that's wizards and prophets, which are basically tech optimists and on one hand, and then environmentalists kind of on the other. Could you say a little bit more about these two different views? And I'm curious to know where you feel like you fall among these two worldviews.
Yeah, wizards and prophets, I find this to be a very useful framing. Charles C. Mann, who wrote 1491 and 1493. He's been on our podcast before. I really like his work, but he wrote a book called The Wizard and the Prophet. And wizards are people who think technology will save us. It will solve problems faster than it creates problems. And prophets do not buy that for one hot second. They think that technology creates more problems than anything, that we need to cut back our desires to retreat, to live within our means, that sort of understanding of how humans should exist. So I like thinkers from both of those traditions too. I think if you are primarily a wizard, you got to have a little bit of prophet in the mix too, because wizards sometimes get really dreamy and they think that everything's going to be solid. There'll be no problems. There's a version of being a wizard that is really annoying that you should not be. But prophets also can be quite annoying as well. They think that we should, I don't know, not do hardly anything. They're not very ambitious. I always think of prophets as wanting to live in Hobbiton, which is a fine place to want to reside. I have a lot of sympathy for that too. Many of the writers that you and I like a lot are prophets. For whatever reasons, whatever reason, prophets are better writers, I think, in many cases. They own the nostalgia genre, like Wendell Berry, Paul Kingsnorth, I don't know, Aldo Leopold, Robin Wall Kimmerer, people like that. I find, whereas if I'm trying to think of a really good wizards, I guess Steven Pinker is probably one, Matt Ridley, Remez Nahm, I don't know. I find, but those books always strike me as somewhat more instrumental. I don't know. Do you understand slash agree with what I'm saying?
I think the framing sets up a dichotomy that is clarifying and helpful to a certain point. And then as you were suggesting, if we become too, dare I say, absolute about one or the other, we close out other possibilities, that there's things that each camp needs to learn from, and that there's probably a fantastic middle way that is sometimes prophetic and sometimes wizardly.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think this lesson should be applied broadly. I think I originally got this from John Stuart Mill in On Liberty. He has a line about how there's always a party of progress and a party of order. You got to have them both. If you don't have the party, if you have the party of order and that's it, society stagnates, because that's just conservatives and they keep everything the same and they don't change when they should. If you have the party of progress, that's when the guillotines start coming out. They have no one to check them, and they try to redesign everything, and it falls apart in a very bad way. When you have them together, ideally it works very well and prevents really bad things from happening. I always say that. I love that model. When I see it in operation in the real world, it doesn't seem like it's working that well, but I love the idea.
I'm very sympathetic to that. I think it's a powerful model, but I do struggle to see how well or how much it manifests right now looking at our current cultural or political moment. But I think it's something that needs to be amplified a bit. And maybe it will become more practice if it's amplified more, or maybe it's just a broken model. I don't know.
It's hard to know too, since there's no counterfactual we can point to and say, aha, look at this future where there's, or this past where there's no conservatives in the country, and see how it all works perfectly slash led to Mad Max within 3 weeks. there's no way you can do it. So I don't know. I think that's sensible though, yeah.
To channel the wizards for a moment, which admittedly on Damn the Absolute, we've probably had some more prophets on the show recently. What are some technologies that give you the most hope or optimism that we'll be able to tackle climate change?
We started with soil, since that's where Nori started, and agriculture. But there's a lot of really interesting industrial methodologies too that are coming online. People are trying to figure out how to remove CO2 from the air and mineralize it, turn it into materials that can be used to build buildings, into consumer products, pump it underground and store it, almost like we pulled oil and gas out of the ground, run the process in reverse and put it back down there. So there's a lot of really interesting technology going on like that. There's a lot of work that involves the ocean that I've been thinking about a lot lately. One of the approaches is to grow macroalgae like kelp, and that grows super fast, stores a lot of CO2. And if you sink it deep enough in the ocean, the way that the ocean's currents work means that if it's down there deep enough, it's probably not going to enter into the carbon cycle for a long time. So it's effectively sequestered. There's also approaches like taking certain types of minerals and either spreading them out on the like land surface or in the water. And it's called enhanced weathering. So weathering has been involved in the climatic processes of the planet for a long time. When you expose certain kinds of rocks to the air, it reacts to ambient air and stores CO2. So what if we mined those rocks and put them in various places, and it can either pull CO2 out of the ocean or the atmosphere? So that's kind of a funky, cool approach that people are thinking about right now. There's a lot though. There's stuff coming out seemingly every week or every couple of weeks. I'm like, oh, new way of doing something. It's exciting.
Those all sound phenomenal. What are, on the other hand, what are some technologies that some people are really hot on that you're skeptical or you think people need to dampen their enthusiasm a little bit?
I try not to do too much of that. I think some of the simple solutions that get bandied, I sometimes find a bit frustrating. Or if someone will say, we just need to plant more trees, you're like, okay, but that competes with the arable land on planet Earth. And there's just not enough room to plant all the trees that are necessary. Also, as the world warms and if the forests aren't managed well, there's a risk that they catch on fire as they do in the West where we live seemingly every summer. Looking forward to that this year. There's a long running fight in carbon removal. Do I want to frame it as a fight? There's a disagreement, basically. There are people who like industrial methodologies and they say there's research that shows to some degree as the world warms over the next coming decades that the ecosphere will be less able to retain carbon. So as the world heats up, maybe jungles and forests go from net storing of carbon to net emitting of carbon. That's pretty scary.
That's terrifying.
And so they say that we shouldn't bet that much on nature and nature-based carbon removal solutions. Alternatively, there are people who say industrial methodologies are never going to scale. The amount of power it would take to run the fans necessary to separate CO2 from ambient air is a waste of time. We're never going to have that much electricity. This is a false solution and it is at risk of being co-opted by fossil fuel interests. So we should not pursue this at all. I'm sort of mixing a couple of things in here, but I tend to be pretty supportive overall. It's too soon to know which of these technologies is going to work best and at which time scales. So Nori tries to be somewhat above that fray and be a booster of the industry so long as ethical and credible. That's what we try to do. So I don't want to say too many bad things about others. I mostly try to look for the upside and be collaborative because it's so early. Carbon removal is pretty new and we need a lot of these shots on goal.
I view Nori as a very wizardly group, but you yourself are someone who has a lot of affinity to the more prophetic tradition. What is the appeal for you of having prophets in the environmentalism and climate change space? What's the draw there?
I think they're a great check. The caricature that wizards run the risk of becoming is this finance tech bro who comes into the climate space thinking that money will solve everything. And you don't want to be that. That's bad. I think people like Wendell Berry and others that get me to zoom in and focus on... Did you ever watch I Heart Huckabees?
I did not.
I really love that movie. It stuck with me for such a long time. There's a lot of great prophetic sentiments in it, but it's also prophetic but mocking of itself, very self-aware. If you haven't seen it, this is not going to make as much sense. But you have this, Jason Schwartzman plays this prophet character who runs a small environmental nonprofit and is trying to save open space. And so the movie opens with him celebrating and reading a poem about their work. And he just saved like 4 square feet and it's just a big rock. He has this poem. It's like, nobody sits like this rock sits. The rock just sits and is. And you're like, that's a great prophetic statement, right? Like, it just is. I like reading things like Wendell Berry or Robin Wall Kimmerer or Mary Oliver or people like that. That reminds me to, you know, pick a flower and look at it and admire it or just be outside and think about how great it feels when the sun hits your body. And those basic biophilic experiences I find really important for grounding something that can be as abstract as where we started with a commoditized carbon removal marketplace. I think if you need to have some of that awareness of the risks of being overly technological, of being overly prescriptive, of being hubristic. Prophets love to mock human hubris. That is what they are made to do. It is what they are best at. So it's good to be reminded of how little you know, how big nature is, how stupid all of your plans are, and how important it is to check that and to be humble. And so maybe that's a good reminder. I'm not sure I even had an answer for that until I started trying to articulate it, but I think I like that. I think I might use that in the future.
There's another framing beside the wizards and prophets, and that's there's often this private versus public division. What are some governmental policies that you think show a lot of great promise for our efforts to reverse climate change?
There's a lot. I'm not sure I have anything specific that I could point to and say, House Bill 772, this is the one-stop shop for all things carbon removal. I think there's some interesting work that's being done. I think basic research is still really important. I think that's also one of those things that even Tyler Cowen has mentioned, that libertarians should be pretty cool overall with basic research, or things like the CDC. Like, this is not an overt threat to liberty. It's one of those things that may not be provided in the right way by the market. So I think that's a fine thing to do. I think there's some real risks with certain types of carbon and climate policy. One of my colleagues and co-founders of NORI, she is very supportive of policies that are performance standards, like how they got led out of gasoline, which is by telling gas companies, basically, you need to get X percent of the lead out of your gasoline every year. We don't care how you do it. Figure it out. We want that met every year. And I think that could be a way to do it with carbon, but I don't know. I worry too, carbon taxes could be regressive. So then people try to do the fee and dividend.
Could you elaborate on that for those of us who are not familiar? What does that look like?
So a carbon tax in general would just be like for every ton of CO2 emitted based upon your purchases or how much gas you consume, you would pay a certain amount of tax, but that runs the risk of being really regressive, right? Demand for energy is relatively inelastic. For instance, if you have to commute to your job, you're going to pay the gas no matter what it costs. So who does that hit the hardest, right? The people least able to pay for it. That doesn't strike anyone as fair, nor should it. So one of the proposed solutions for this is a form of refund. So if you're under a certain amount of income, this would come as a tax credit for you. So that gets proposed often. I think there's some risks of getting government hooked on various types of like sin taxes. Because then, like, do they actually want people to stop smoking cigarettes? I don't know. they like probably like getting, like, if you're in New York City, you probably like getting that nice, big, healthy amount of tax. Anyways, though, I think some of these simpler things are good. I think even just basic research and supporting, I mean, that's one of the reasons why solar panels are so cheap right now. Solar panels had quite a lot of money pumped in from the US, and also Germany is quite famous for this too, of supporting the development of that technology. And solar is now cheaper than, I think, essentially anything else for many, many places, which is exciting. It's no longer a political fight when it's just cheaper than the alternative. And I think that's a really big win when that happens.
Hello friends, Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. You're a communications guy. You run your own podcast. You're thinking all the time about how you can communicate with others about the climate change crisis. What are some of the most diplomatic ways you found to convince or persuade others to be a little bit more urgent about addressing climate change?
I don't know. I kind of just do my thing. I try to meet people where they are. I think that's important. I think one of the things I'm either best at or maybe worst at, if you don't like this approach, but I try to invite people along for an intellectual adventure, which sounds kind of pretentious. I don't mean it that way. I just try to stay really curious. In fact, I feel kind of weird being on a show like this. I had to give a presentation recently, and I don't think I did a very good job because I don't know that I have a lot of answers. I think I'm pretty good at asking questions and facilitating discussions about ideas. But if I have to solve the world's problems and tell you this is exactly how to think about it and do it, I don't know that I shine in the same kind of way. I find it actually really challenging. And I almost wish more people did find it challenging, because I think people think they have way too many answers, and probably more than they in reality actually hold.
You don't strike me as someone who takes a more alarmist approach to communicating about climate change. And what I mean by that, there's another approach that I think contrasts with your more curiosity approach of communicating as if the world is ending, which it very well could be. In what ways do you see being too alarmist might be detrimental? Or what does being too alarmist look like to you?
I mean, Greta Thunberg is probably the most famous person like this. I think she's responsible for quite a lot of attention being put on climate change now. Although she was not persuasive to many of the people that I predicted she would not be persuasive with. So many of the conservatives and libertarians I know, she did not receive a warm reception from them. So, I mean, it's an open question too, to what degree are those people reachable in that kind of way and at scale? And some of that is starting to shift. There are groups like the American Conservation Coalition that are trying to get more conservatives or like market-friendly people to think about climate change because they're worried that if they just say this is not a problem, they're going to be left out in the cold in all these discussions. If you want markets to be represented and private property to be represented in climate policy making, you got to engage. You can't just deny it's a problem. So, but I don't know. Some of that stuff feels relatively like a sideshow still. We'll see. We'll see if it keeps playing out. But it might just be a difference in audience. What we do is somewhat, I think, a little bit unique, or like our voice is somewhat idiosyncratic. And it's not for everyone. That's one thing too you have to get used to if you're podcasting at all. For instance, reversing climate change is in a crowded field, especially since How to Save a Planet came along. Gimlet put out a climate podcast. It's hard to go toe-to-toe with Gimlet. So if Gimlet starts up a pragmatism podcast, you're in deep trouble, my friend. I don't think it's going to happen. I think you're safe for now. So I don't know. People probably just respond to this unique kind of voice. And there are other shows that are probably a bit closer to Greta in tone. And that's fine. I don't think one tone is going to rule them all. There's something for everyone. One of the reasons I like podcasting a lot is that it gives people a chance to have their approach. And people might find your show for the title. They might find it for the topics, but they're going to stick around for you and your colleagues and peers that are on the show in your particular weird little approach on your corner of the internet. So I'm fine if others have more of an alarmist tone. I don't necessarily know that that is wrong. In fact, I think for the right kind of person, that can be very motivating. That being said, there is some research that shows being a bit alarmist can also turn a lot of people off. I don't know where the data comes down on that one.
Your pluralistic approach, I appreciate. I will applaud you on that. You have a lot of kinship here. There's another method that I think is really interesting. And I don't want to necessarily call it sneaky, but it can be. And that's literature. Literature has a profound way of changing the way we view things in kind of subtle ways as compared to a political argument that's just straightforward, trying to move your thinking according to premises. Whereas literature, you just find yourself finishing a novel and suddenly you realize you're on this other side of this gap that you were on before. What are some novels that you would recommend that you find really compelling in helping to shift yourself or others toward being more environmentally conscious?
Probably the easiest place to start is Kim Stanley Robinson's The Ministry for the Future, which plays out a near future of the climate crisis, of what happens when there's the first mega drought and heat wave, and it happens in India. This is very early in the book. This is not giving anything away. And then reactions to it, what India does to try to prevent another heat wave and sort of the global politics around climate. And President Obama said it was one of his favorite books from last year. Everyone's been talking about it in climate circles. He's been on our podcast. There's a strong blockchain component to it, which is really interesting. There's a lot of things in there that I think are going to be very influential. But I don't know that I think that's the correct way to go. I guess one other thing, there's a bunch of cli-fi books. Climate fiction as a genre or subgenre is more and more prominent, and there's quite a lot going on in there. There's also things like Wendell Berry and his novels that'll do it. Oh, man.
Does climate fiction feel too heavy-handed in the way of there's a clear agenda and then a story's just an afterthought? How much of the climate fiction feels that way?
Yeah, I have a... So in between the grad school like attempt that I made and now I was trying to break into screenwriting and was working on a bunch of scripts. And I broadly think of writing as having two approaches where you can be a theme oriented or character oriented. And since I like ideas like you, I often would come into a story wanting to talk about theme, what I'm trying to express or satirize or point out. And I had friends who were much more intuitionistic about it. They would be like, I have this character who's like this, and they're in this room and there's this image, and you're just like, that doesn't mean anything. That's just sort of like a vision that you had. But in the same pluralistic spirit, I would often work very well with those people because I would help them bring structure and theme, and they would oftentimes have this lightning in a bottle, just directorial excess that would be perfect. So we would often team up on writing projects or actually making things. So you're totally right, though. There's a real risk with all of the speculative fiction, historical fiction, climate fiction, science fiction. All of these have a risk of being thought experiments, very obviously so, with characters that are there to serve that thematic vision. And I think that's a real risk for the genre. There's not a lot on just the more character-oriented front like that, starting from character. The only thing I would say is that I think some of the best climate writing is more ecological or environmental. Like, go read Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac. Book is very funny and very beautiful about nature. Or read some Mary Oliver poems, something like that. Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass is also really a fantastic book that's very imagistic, very, I don't know, it just makes you appreciate the small little biophilic moments of being in the yard, feeling the breeze, looking at, if you just like zoom in on your grass or something, or like look inside of a tree and see all the life happening there. I think that does a lot of good, more so than these more geopolitical thrillers or something like that. Or at least for me, I prefer them. Maybe that's a better way to say it.
To go back a little bit into the more overtly political, most people of most stripes or orientations are at least interested, if not focused, on climate change. That means there's a lot of divergent ideologies that people bring with them into the environmental space or conservation space. How do you navigate these divergent ideologies and get people to work together? How do you build coalitions or campaigns when people may agree on climate change as an issue, but they even disagree on which approaches are likely to work? And then they bring with them all the other disagreements they have on other economic and social policies.
I don't know. I'm not sure that I've fully cracked this one. I think pluralism is really all that I've got. Pluralism and curiosity, maybe. And there's a St. Francis of Assisi quote that I've always enjoyed, which is, spread the gospel wherever you go, use words if necessary. And I think just trying to model those behaviors and making this a fun, open-ended intellectual adventure is a way that I know how to do it. And it appeals to some people. To some people, though, if they listen to the show that I work on, they might think that I am overly charitable, that I should be less curious and have more answers, that I am waffling. I don't know. People are usually nicer than that, but I'm open to those charges. So I think if there are people who are skeptical of climate change, I think someone like what I'm doing is a lot less threatening. It at least invites them into a discussion. Many of these questions are endlessly fascinating too. I feel really lucky to work in a space like this. So I had that, you know, trying out grad school for a year, screenwriting, I see my interest in ideas with a strong sense of continuity between all of these career choices. The line is, there's no such thing as a career. It's just your jobs and a story you tell yourself when you get older about this continuity that you're imagining backwards. But it is all ideas driven. That's what I like to talk about. It's what I like to do. And it's why I'm here. So I think for the right kind of person, my approach can be valuable to them. But I think people in general like the simple answers, though, Jeffrey. I think people want to feel like they're a part of the team and they're beating the other team. I do not offer that, I don't think. So I don't know that I am that successful is what I'm trying to say.
For those listeners who want to do better, I know each of us are going to be, we find ourselves in different circumstances that are going to dictate different actions we can take to contribute to reversing or better managing climate change. But what are the closest, a few concrete practices you think most people can adopt to find themselves probably on the right side of history?
All right. I have a good example of is either a fantastic moment of podcasting or an incredibly grim one. But I had this fan of our show write in, and his kids are homeschooled, and they were working on a podcast of them talking to people working on climate change and asked me to do it. I said, oh, sure, that sounds fun. And they asked me this question too. And here's the sort of ridiculous answer that I gave was, well, I live in an apartment in Seattle, and that means I can walk to work so I don't drive. But my living in that apartment, given that the city doesn't build more apartments, just meant that someone else had to live farther away from their work to compensate for one less room being available on the market. So I'm not sure that I did anything. It makes me feel good, but I don't know that it changed literally anything. And that was like the best answer that I could have given. And isn't that depressing? I think I have a better one for you though, which is I think eating factory farm meat is bad. I think it's definitely not good for the environment. It's not good for the animals. I'm not even sure how good it is for you. Those animals aren't eating things they're meant to eat. They're pumped full of antibiotics in many cases. I don't think it's great. I think if you're going to eat meat, you should try to make it more of an occasion and buy something that's regeneratively raised, pasture raised, shown a good life, maybe someone where you even know the farmer and trust them to some degree. I am also an enormous hypocrite though, where I ate at a fast food place the other day. So I try my best, but I'm just riddled with failure. So I don't think you have to be perfect, but I think aspiring that direction, I think is really valuable. I think that's the one.
I think most of us are riddled with a certain degree of guilt around the sort of moral tragic nature of our choices that we can't really fully know the ramifications of any of them. We just do the best we can.
Yeah, I think that's just being a human in some regards. And yeah, is that a grim place to leave it? I feel like we're heading towards the wrap. And we're going to just depress your
audience. I can give you another swing if you want, Ross. I don't have, I was going to leave that as a final question.
At the same question?
I can give you one more swing if you want to leave with a more hopeful final delivery.
One thing I think is really important that if you listen to any sort of survival advice for natural disasters or anything like that, the best thing you can do is know your neighbors. And I think that is good in so many ways. I think meeting with people that don't agree with you about everything, but still might be able to share affection with, still be able to do things, have a block parties, go to church, go to the Elks Club, stuff like that, I think is still very underserved these days. I think we mostly just go home from our jobs and yell at people on the internet for fun. That's sort of all we got. So I think if climate change is not addressed in adequate time, I think we are going to have a fair number of crises. And doing your small part to know the people who live on your street and help each other out, I think that's the kind of thing that could help. And it's also a no regrets kind of policy. If climate change is dealt with, here's an enormous bunch of reasons for why knowing your neighbors is a great idea, to which I know you have exhaustively bored your audience, Jeffrey.
Ross, thank you so much for offering us a pluralistic walk through the climate change landscape, some of the solutions, a good mix of doom and gloom, which we are about here. So thanks again for coming on the show and best of luck with all you're doing with Nori.
Thanks for having me. I also really like what you do and respect the vision of it and look forward to listening to more.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.